I'm not blaming the philosophers for that. I'm just explaining sociologically why I don't spend much time on it. But, you know, if I'm at a conference and having a glass of beer with somebody and they're interested, I'm glad to talk about it. So we're having coffee now, but I'd be happy to talk more about it right now, too.
Welcome to About Logic. And in this week's podcast, we have Steve Awoudy here, one of the fathers of homotopy type theory. And we will talk about the relations of philosophy and math, but also the main ideas between geometric thinking and logic and what all this has to do with computer science.
So welcome to the About Logic podcast. Today we have Steve Awoudy from CMU, Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. And I'm very happy. And thank you very much, Steve, for agreeing. We know each other for quite a while.
My pleasure.
It's good to have you here. How would you describe your interests? You've written a book about category theory, and you're very involved in this HOT project. So how would you describe what drives you, maybe?
Thank you very much for inviting me to this conversation, Torsten and Dennis. It's nice to meet you. I wasn't sure exactly what I'm dodging your question for the moment, and then I'll get back to it.
That's fair enough.
Okay.
Yes, totally fine.
Then Torsten invited me to a podcast, which he said was about logic and philosophy of mathematics, maybe something like that. Yeah. And initially I declined because I said, I don't do philosophy anymore. I'm devoting all my time now to mathematics. So I don't know if I should say that for the public record here. If my boss hears that, maybe I'll suffer some repercussion. But Torsten assured me that the discussion could be about anything we really want, and that there's interest in all different topics and so on. So maybe I start by saying that that's not to say that philosophy is off limits. That's just to say that I no longer really spend a lot of time thinking about philosophy. It's not what drives me. I discovered at some point when I started doing HOT that the mathematics takes up more of my energy and time and thought, mental capacity, than the philosophy does. And if I'm going to do a proper job of it, I need to make time for it and focus on it. And so for the last, I'd say more than 10 years or so, I've really been spending most of my time thinking about mathematics, just because I have a limited mental capacity. Maybe I'm getting old or something like that, and my brain is slowing down, and I don't have time to think about philosophy anymore. I would do it if I had infinitely much time, but the mathematical problems somehow, it's not that I consider them more important or something like that. It's just they take more time and energy to do properly, and so I don't have time left for everything. So that's just as a preface. Like now, for example, last week I went to visit Jonathan Weinberger in Chapman University, and he's a new assistant professor in a program that's devoted to philosophy, physics, and mathematics. And I give a talk that was a philosophy talk on maybe a motivation for HOT coming from Frege's early semantics of sense and reference and the morning star and the evening star and all that stuff that the philosophers like. And I was trying to motivate HOT by connecting up ideas from Martin Luft type theory and homotopy type theory with some of those old-fashioned problems in the philosophy of language. And I came away and I had some conversations with some philosophers there, and I felt like, oh, this is fun after all. Maybe I should do some more of this. Maybe I should write this talk as a paper. Maybe I should whatever. And I resolved to maybe spend some more time on it. And since I've left, It's been a week or and a half. Now I've been stuck on a problem involving a certain hyper doctrine that turns out not to be a pi tribe. And that I find that much more fascinating. And so I'm thinking a lot more about that. It's a kind of mathematical semantics for homotopy type theory that was invented by André Joël. And when I given a choice between thinking about those two different problems, I find myself more fascinated by the latter, the mathematical one. And that's just me, I guess. It's just what I, you know, it's like a, I know when you start doing formalizations, that's like a video game. You can't put it down. And it's that kind of thing. The mathematics has a kind of compelling, I don't know, fascination for me. And the philosophy, I'm happy to talk about it. And especially when somebody else is interested and engaged, then I'm interested in doing that. But if you leave me alone, I'll start thinking about some mathematical problem, and then that'll be the end of that. So that's to answer your question, Torsten, and maybe a long-winded answer, but that's what I'm thinking about more. Yeah, I'm thinking more about mathematical, and specifically what I'm really interested in is mathematical descriptions of Martin Löf type theory and homotopy type theory, which we can talk more about if you want. It's a foundational system for constructive mathematics that is connected to homotopy theory and so on. It also has a long history and philosophical aspects, but I'm interested in the mathematical semantics of that system. And that's what I've been thinking about a lot lately.
But I wonder, is there such a clear demarcation between philosophy and mathematics? And it seems to me that the sort of kind of mathematics you are thinking about is very much sort of influenced by, I would say, philosophical consideration.
I would like to sell it as philosophy. If people would buy it in that package, I'd be happy to sell it to them. And I think there's some legitimacy in that. I mean, if you look at historically work in conceptually motivated mathematical logic, it has philosophical maybe motivations and implications and so on. So the mathematical work too is a branch of exact philosophy. Certainly there were historically philosophers who considered, you know, mathematical logic to be an important part of philosophy. And maybe that's a good way of reconciling my interest in pursuing mathematical semantics for homotopy type theory with philosophical motivations or whatever, is that it is philosophy. You could just, I could just bang my fist on the table and say, it is philosophy. It's mathematical logic is a branch of philosophy.
I mean, there
I don't know if that's legit.
There's some remaining evidence of this culture in our conference system nowadays. I mean, we put together logic and philosophy of mathematics into one track normally at philosophy conferences. And I guess this is still from those times. But I mean, nowadays, there's, of course, the problem that mathematical logic is advancing. And so the audience that can really understand the nuances and is interested in philosophy is, I mean, not empty, but of course, a smaller cut than,
that's true. And we see the same thing. I agree with you. And I see the same thing happening in the Association for Symbolic Logic. Maybe that's an American association, but it has a European section, and it has a conference every year in the European Logic Colloquium and so on. But if you look at the journal of the Symbolic Logic, most of the papers are mathematical. And then the papers that are more philosophical tend to go into the journal of whatever, the Bulletin of Symbolic Logic or the Review of Symbolic Logic. I'm not speaking as an editor here. I'm just speaking from practice. But so there is a split. And at the meetings, too, you know, sometimes there will be a philosophy section or something at one of the meetings. but there tends to be quite a split between the two.
But don't you think it's important to explain these ideas? Also, I mean, mathematics sounds obvious, like we're going for more specialization, and in the end, nobody understands anymore what we're doing. Isn't it important to, to explain, especially, I mean, you mentioned homotopy type theory, I think this, in my view, the name is maybe a bit misleading, because it's just sort of the penultimate type theory, and this is a very important discovery. So shouldn't we work to spread, because there seem to be still many people not realizing the sort of fundamental revolution, and you're very instrumental in bringing it along. So I'm a bit sad by what you're saying. You seem to be given up on this very important aspect a bit, at least.
Well, thanks for saying so. I appreciate that, and I agree with you that it's an important advance in foundations of mathematics and logic, and it has or should have. Let me put it this way. It has a great deal of importance for philosophy too, and it should have a large impact on philosophy of mathematics, but I'm afraid that it hasn't. And maybe I'm just too impatient. I wrote a couple of papers, even one I started when we were at the Institute together, Torsten. I realized that it took a long time to really digest and metabolize univalence.
Yes.
Because it was, at first, it was so surprising and shocking and mysterious. But as I came to understand it, I realized how important it was also for topics that philosophers care about. And so I did try to reach out to the philosophers, and I wrote a couple of papers and I gave a couple of talks. But then it really didn't go anywhere, and nobody didn't get much of a reception. And so I didn't pursue that. And maybe it's just being impatient, or maybe it's moving on to other topics that I was more interested in. One thing is, you know, if you try different things and one thing gets a good reception and another thing doesn't, then you pursue the thing that's getting a good reception. And what was working for me was the connections to homotopy theory. And so I spent a lot of time working out the stuff, learning Quillen model categories, proving stuff like that. Whereas the philosophical papers about the structure identity principle and the connection between univalence and invariance and structuralism, which is something the philosophers are very interested in, I think, they still write papers about it, that didn't go anywhere. And nobody read those papers, and nobody, invited me to come for a seminar or whatever. I tried to talk to people about it, and it didn't really go anywhere. So I'm not blaming the philosophers for that. I'm just explaining sociologically why I don't spend much time on it. But, if I'm at a conference and having a glass of beer with somebody and they're interested, I'm glad to talk about it. So we're having coffee now, but I'd be happy to talk more about it right now, too. I see a great, and as you suggested, Torsten, a deep connection between univalence and the idea of invariance and structuralism in the philosophy of mathematics. And that's, I should say, I've been interested in structuralism and philosophy of mathematics and so on from way back. I wrote papers about category theory and structuralism and things like that when I was a grad student even. And so the univalence, I think, is a breakthrough in that respect. And let me just say, that's not my idea. Univalence is Vygotsky's idea. My idea was the homotopical interpretation of type theory, which makes univalence possible. But Vygotsky certainly is the one who came up with univalence. I don't want to suggest I'm taking any credit for that. But it's a beautiful idea, and it has a big, I think, importance for philosophy.
For the audience, can you just summarize what univalence is, if you don't mind?
Oh, sure. So in everyday, old-fashioned Frege, Russell, Gödel, Carnap, I should do the other order, Frege, Russell, Carnap, Gödel, predicate logic, there's an identity relation, as we know from the history of logic going way back. Identity is a logical relation, but it's kind of trivial in that predicate logic that the students learn and that we all learned maybe as undergraduates, because either if you give me two mathematical objects, either they're equal or they're not, and that's the end of the story. But as Frege observed in the introduction to the Begriffsschrift, there are deep problems that follow from the relation of equality. And if you pursue that line of thought, what you see is equality is a much more subtle relation from a mathematical and logical point of view than we at first observe. And one of the ideas coming from, well, let's go back a little bit to Martin Löf type theory, is that the equality, or as Martin Löf calls it, identity relation, can be proof relevant. The idea of proof relevance is a type theorist's way of saying that a relation is more than just on or off, yes or no. It has some content. It can have content. Some relations don't have any content, but some do. And one way of cashing that out is to say, well, you look at the meaning of the relation is all of the proofs of that relation. That's a proof theoretic way of describing what's going on there. But there are other ways of describing it too. Per Martin Löf thought of it as proof relevance. So the meaning maybe of a proposition is the collection of all of its proofs. That would be the propositions as types idea. But in homotopy type theory, we have a refinement, maybe, of the propositions as types conception, where every type has not only its own identity relation, which is not only yes or no, but a whole collection of proofs of identity, but an even richer structure. And the richer structure comes from the fact that the identity relation, if you take seriously the idea that it's proof relevant, then there's an identity relation on identity proofs. And that's proof relevant too, right? And so, for example, you might have a proof that two things are equal or identical, and then you might have another one, and they might be identical or not. And if they are identical, there might be other ways in which they can be identical. And that structure leads to a hierarchy, or we say a tower of identity types, which have a very rich structure. For example, reflexivity of identity, which we all know well, everything is equal to itself, as Frege already observed, and Aristotle, I'm sure. The identity, the reflexivity of identity leads to an identity path on every object. Now I'm using the homotopical terminology. And two identities compose. That's a transitivity of identity. And identity is symmetric, so you can reverse an identity. And this structure, it turns out, is the same as, or at least can be described as, the structure that occurs in a topological space if you look at the continuous paths between points of the space. And that structure, which was discovered already by Poincaré and called a fundamental group of a space at a point, if you look at all the continuous paths at a point, that forms a group. That actually has a higher dimensional structure where you look at deformations, continuous deformations of the continuous paths as higher paths between the paths. And those are like the higher identities between the identities. And this structure is a what the homotopy theorist calls an infinity groupoid. It's a category in which every arrow is invertible, but the category structure and the inversion structure only holds up to a higher dimension of structure, which itself is an infinity groupoid, and so on. So this notion was introduced by Grothendieck, the celebrated famous mathematician, maybe the greatest mathematician of the 20th century. I don't know. Those kinds of things are easy to throw around. But He introduced this idea of an infinity groupoid as a way of classifying homotopy types of topological spaces. Those are the idea of a space regarded up to continuous deformation. So this is a mathematical idea that has occurred naturally in the world, right? Homotopy types of spaces and continuous deformations. And then it pops up in infinite dimensional algebra in the form of an infinity groupoid. And now what we discovered is this happens in Martin Lef's intentional type theory. These infinity groupoids occur in the type theory. We don't put them in. We don't add any axioms. We discovered that they're there. So this is an amazing coincidence of ideas. It's one of those kinds of coincidences of ideas that doesn't happen very often. And when it does happen, you should take note, I think. And the philosophers could take note of this amazing occurrence that these infinity groupoids occur in the foundations, deep in the foundations of mathematics. And that's a kind of connection between foundations and type theory and homotopy theory. So, sorry, go ahead.
There's a connection between what one could call very abstract geometry, right? I mean, the theory of spaces. Yeah. And type theory, which is something like very discrete in the sense of, I mean, people usually learn about sets, but I mean, okay, we use types and there are some subtle differences, but basically these very structures which are on the basis of mathematics, yeah? And if you look at them no close enough, then it emerges that this relation to homotopy theory, to abstract geometry exists. I find this already absolutely, I mean, fascinating,
I agree.
This fact, yeah.
Yeah, it's quite fascinating, I agree. And maybe it should urge us to revise our idea about the foundations of mathematics being in the discrete, where we have this idea that maybe mathematics should be built up from elements and discrete bits and computation with finite sets and the arithmetic of the numbers is closely tied, and that's the basis of mathematics. But there's another kind of mathematics which deals with maybe continuous deformation and transformation in space and time, and as you said, geometry, abstract geometry. And it turns out, maybe through this connection in type theory, that we can get a glimpse of a way of understanding the fundamentals of mathematics in a more continuous way or a more spatial, topological way that's not discrete. I mean, there has always been in the history of mathematics this kind of tension or duality between the discrete and the continuous. But in foundations, we usually fall on the side of the discrete, as you already said. But it seems that there's also a continuous or geometric side of foundations that maybe has been overlooked and which now we can see coming up in this type theory, that the basic types of type theory are not discrete sets. They're some sort of, they have an integrity as a continuous objects or mathematical objects which can be deformed, which can change, which can be stretched, and which have an internal structure which can be infinitely complex. It's not just a discrete set of points. There's a great quote from Frege. I wish I could find it, but I'll just paraphrase it and you can splice it in later if you want. It's from the conclusion of the preface, or maybe the introduction to the Begriffsschrift, where Frege says, I believe that my Begriffsschrift will be of great use in those areas where precision in the proofs is of the greatest importance. For example, in the differential and integral calculus. And indeed, we could imagine adding a concept with some geometric content to the Begriffsschrift, and that would allow us to reason also about geometric objects in a similarly precise way, and it would imbue the system with a geometric meaning. And I think that's so close to what we are actually doing, is we take the existing system of the Begriffsschrift, which is a kind of logical system, and we add a little bit of geometric content at one point. But because the system is this tightly interconnected network of concepts, the geometric content flows through the entire system. And now it becomes a system for reasoning about geometric objects as well. So it's very much, I think, in the spirit of Frege's conception there of what he was doing.
May I?
Yeah, or, please.
Yes. So maybe just one short question. There is a lovely story how the discrete pops out of the continuous, and maybe it's something.
Yeah.
I'm not sure whether I'm up to date, but the version I know still goes with the circle.
Yeah.
Is this still how you get the discrete out? Would you like to tell our audience?
Well, I mean, in type
theory...
How
do we get arithmetic, so to speak?
Yeah. In type theory, there are... One can identify properties of types which are describable within the theory, and one can reason about a type having a structure of a certain level or a certain kind. And there are some types which are merely propositions. They're yes or no. And there are other types which are essentially discrete. They're sets of discrete points up to homotopy. And then there are other types that are groupoids. They have paths which are non-trivial, and so on up. There's a whole hierarchy of such types, all the way up to types which don't have, which have an infinite structure. And so the discrete is a definable characteristic of some types which occur in type theory. So you don't have to construct a discrete thing out of continuous things, but you can identify which things you have that you have constructed are discrete. And one of the basic ways of getting discrete things is by an induction starting from some discrete things. Like the natural numbers are usually defined in type theory as an inductive type generated by a starting point and then an operation. And if you take the free thing or the inductive thing generated by that, that's the logician or the logic students will be familiar with Peano's description of the natural numbers. If you do that construction in type theory, you will obtain something which is essentially discrete in the sense that I was just mentioning. It will be a set of points, essentially. So the discrete arises naturally within type theory. It's just that not everything that arises is discrete. For example, the universe of all types is not discrete. That's maybe the most basic example of something that's not a zero type in the previous sense, in the sense of being discrete, because a type itself may have some structure, it may have some automorphisms. And so the universe of all types will contain points that have automorphisms. And that just, it just is in the nature of things.
Yeah. I'd like to tell a story.
Okay.
Martin Hoffmann was a good friend of mine, and he and Thomas Streicher, they were also thinking about type theory, and in particular exactly about this question: is the equality type discrete, right? Which I think Martin Löw did not really answer. He thought, given his laws, equality type would be discrete, and it was Martin and Thomas who proved the contrary using the Grubwein model. And the Grubwein model shows that, as you say, that the type theory is not that you can actually not prove that equality is discrete. That, that Pierre Martin Loew basically left open this door to the type theory we have now. But I don't think he was doing this intentionally. I think it's an over-interpretation. I think he was just doing it basically by accident. Yeah,
I think that's right. I think that's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah, but then we went together and we discussed this and we realized that the groupoid model still has got one level higher a discrete structure. So it's not really a very principled approach, but it's very sort of cut off here. And we said, oh, we should go to have infinity groupoids. And we started on a whiteboard writing down laws of infinity groupoids. And we very quickly, it was absolutely impossible. I mean, we try to do this algebraically, which is a killer. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we thought, okay, forget about this. And years later, when Vladimir Vovotsky started to post on the Koch mailing list, he posted a paper about the homotopy lambda calculus, and I didn't understand the word. Yeah. But I thought I wanted to find out more about this. So I sent him an email and said, is this maybe what you're doing? Is this maybe related to the groupoid model? And he went back and says, no, yeah, actually, infinity groupoids. And I realized that he, because he comes from homotopy theory, for him, an infinity groupoid is a very natural structure. And there's a very straightforward description from this geometric perspective. Yeah. So in a way, I would say these things, they are not this or that. But here's our intuition. Which intuition works better? And the sort of algebraic approach, the sort of discrete approach, just didn't. We were not able to actually understand what an infinity groupoid is. But because of Vovotsky coming from it, had a different background. Yeah, had this super ability. Yeah, to do this. And I think that was this is an important combination in a way to combine these views, right?
Yeah, that's a really good account of the background of these ideas. I think Pear originally, as you said, left the possibility open that the identity types are not just discrete. He, in fact, in one of his early systems, he declared them to be discrete. And then he later realized that spoils the computational uses of the system. And it also violates his philosophical scruples that motivated the system. And so he dropped that condition and went back to the identity type, which he did have a kind of, let's say, philosophical motivation for, but he didn't really understand it because it was not evidently discrete. And so it was hard to understand, and the type theorists had difficulty comprehending what was happening there. And it wasn't until the groupoid that we model that we realized that something subtle and interesting was going on. It made sense, finally, of the non-discrete character of the identity types. But then, as you said, we quickly realized, because every type has an identity type, that the identity type has an identity type, and that's not discrete either.
Yeah,
and then if you know a little bit of mathematics or algebraic topology or category theory, then you say, oh, infinity groupoid, maybe it's an infinity groupoid. But once you start to try to do it, it's hard. And we tried to do it as well. It's around CMU. This was before Vladimir. And we did manage to prove that every type is a globular infinity groupoid, which is one of the definitions of infinity groupoid, not the homotopical one, but a weak algebraic one. And that was Peter Lumsdaine's dissertation. And then after that, we got in touch with Vladimir because we heard about his lectures at Stanford on the homotopy lambda calculus and so on. And we invited him to visit, and he came and visited. I remember I picked him up at the hotel, and the first thing he asked me is, so what are your students? What are you doing? What have you been talking about? And I said, well, we have this proof that every type is a weak infinity groupoid. And he couldn't believe it. He stopped. He said, you have a proof of it? Because for him, it was just an analogy, an intuition. And I said, yeah, we've got a proof. We prove that every type gives rise to a weak infinity groupoid. And he was really I think, excited about that idea because it confirmed his intuition of what was happening in the type theory. So, yeah, that was a really important breakthrough. But maybe, are we running? Yeah, we're kind of getting toward the end, I guess. Maybe we should go on to univalence. As much as I like this idea of the homotopy theory and the interpretation of identity types as spaces and infinity groupoids, and according to Grothendieck, those are just homotopy types of spaces, there's still this breakthrough then that came from Vladimir after that, which was the univalence idea. And I think that's a really profound thing that the philosophers might be able to take an interest in. So I can describe it kind of briefly now that we've talked about infinity groupoids and the fact that every type has its tower of identity types, and that's an infinity groupoid, and it makes the type into a kind of infinite dimensional structure. We can ask about specific types, like what about the type of all functions from one type to another? That has an identity type too. What is an identity between two functions? And there we can kind of unpack that structure in terms of the domain and range of the function. We say if it takes identical elements to identical elements, then, well, every function does that. But if two functions, blah, blah, blah. So we can unpack the identity type on the function space. What about the universe? That's something in type theory. What's the identity type on the universe? Can we unpack that in terms of the types in the universe? Well, in type theory, in Martin Luft type theory, there's no such description. The identity type is a primitive structure. So all we know about it is it's an infinity groupoid. We can prove that about the type theory. But if the universe, if the type that we're interested in is a universe of types, so it itself contains as terms types, then there's another possible description of a relation on those types, and that's the equivalence of types. That's a definable structure on the universe, is equivalence of types. Two types are equivalent in the sense of homotopy theory if you can map back and forth, and the composites of the maps in each case is homotopic to the identity on that type. So it's like isomorphism of two objects. Everybody knows what an isomorphism is between two sets. But this is a generalization which replaces the identity relation on the sets by, well, homotopy, which is given by the identity types in the system, right? The identity types are interpreted as paths or homotopies. So it's the very natural internalization of the notion of isomorphism, is equivalence of types. And now if you have a universe and the objects in the universe are types, then a very natural relation on the universe is isomorphism of types or equivalence of types. And what the univalence axiom says is that notion of equivalence of types agrees with the identity type on the universe. So there's a kind of a priori first choice of what should be the right notion of identity for two types. And it's this generalization of isomorphism, it's equivalence of types. And what the univalence principle or axiom or condition says is that's the right notion that is the identity type on the universe. If you take two types and you take their Cartesian product, you might think the natural notion of identity on the Cartesian product is just pairs of identities. If you take the notion of a universe and you say, what's the natural notion of identity? If you think about it for a few minutes, the first thing you'll come up with is, well, it should be isomorphism. Well, in type theory, isomorphism is equivalence of types. And that's what the univalence axiom says, is the natural notion of identity is the identity type. and it has amazing consequences, but it's not mind-bending. Once you bend your mind into that place, then it's the obvious thing.
I would go further.
Yeah.
I think it's the only choice.
Yeah.
For a number of reasons. I mean, can you define another relation on types which behaves like an equality? No, you can't.
Yeah.
And also, I would also now quote this Leibniz principle. If you have two types and in a type theory, unlike set theory, you cannot distinguish objects by their elements, because the element always belongs to a type. So you cannot say, oh, the empty set is an element of this type, but it's not an element of this type, because you cannot talk about the empty set in isolation.
Yeah.
And because of this structural principle of type theory, is you cannot distinguish isomorphic structures or isomorphic types.
Absolutely.
And by Leibniz, the equality of indiscernibles, they have to be equal. So I would go further. There's not just the natural choice of equality, it's the only possible choice.
It's the only choice. Yeah.
But for how structuralist theory, it's the
absolutely
only choice,
structuralism.
Right? And there's the big philosophical moment.
It's absolutely structuralism. It tells you that two types which are isomorphic are the same for all practical purposes, in the sense of they have all the same properties. They satisfy all the same conditions. And moreover, even richer than properties, they have all the same structures. Mm-hmm. Any structure on one is also a structure on the other.
Yeah. They're as equal as morning star and evening star. Right?
Exactly, yeah, exactly.
I mean, let me tell you one little story. With linguists,
please.
We worked on equivalence of stories, and we asked people about their opinion. And of course, epistemology and ontology are different things. But there, some people insisted that if you change the color of the cape of the little girl who goes into the woods, then it's a new story. So even so, it's structurally very equivalent. And we hoped that people would say, Romeo and Juliet and Avatar, that's the same story. But people didn't agree. I mean, of course, they were untrained. They were not mathematicians. Nope. But there are different competing intuitions there. So maybe the color of the cape is essential.
Yeah.
But this is maybe just an anecdote, not a proper contribution to the philosophy of math.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a good point.
I don't want to stop anything if you want to develop it further. But for me, one point we haven't talked so much about is logic is often claimed to be like the isolated case within the math community and set theory. For instance, it's sometimes said they aren't that linked to other fields of math in comparison to topology. And I mean, your story is one of connecting worlds in very different sense, right? We have these deep results now in topology by logical methods you mentioned. We connected people like the homotopy theorists with the logicians. Is there a chance that we find a few moments to talk about that? How this viewpoint can create new math for the mathematician?
It's true that current logic is quite separate from much other mathematical research, but I think you can say the same thing about any area of mathematics.
Yeah. Maybe that's true.
That's just the nature of mathematics nowadays. But what is exciting is when one finds a connection between one area and another, and that's something that has happened with homotopy type theory, is we did find a connection between logic and topology and geometry and homotopy theory, which seems to be quite robust, and that makes it interesting from a mathematical point of view, and I guess from a philosophical point of view too, is what we've been arguing that it should, or discussing that it should be of interest to philosophers who like to study conceptual connections between different areas of mathematics or different areas of science and so forth. I mean, people who do history of mathematics are very interested in the development of the calculus in connection with physics and applications in physics, right? So that's the sort of phenomenon that we have here. instead of looking at the connection between the differential calculus and the development of Riemannian geometry and the theory of manifolds and space-time and so on, here we have a connection between mathematical logic and the foundations of mathematics and the theory of homotopy theory and the development of abstract homotopy theory and so on. So from that kind of sociological point of view, I think it's quite fascinating that there's one of these instances where a bridge is found between two different areas of science or mathematics, and ideas flow back and forth. And then from a sociological point of view, one can look at what's happening and how the two fields interact and how ideas influence each other. I don't know about a deeper, more explicitly philosophical point about the nature of mathematical objects or something like that. I don't want to get into that.
Maybe it's just motivation for the Langlands program.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Maybe, yeah.
I mean, something.
But maybe. So what you didn't explicitly mention is the sort of a synthetic use of homotopy types theory, right? I mean, as we know, there are structures which are interesting from a mathematical point of view. They're very popular as the infinity categories, right?
True.
And they're very, very difficult to describe analytical. In the language of set theory, almost impossible, basically.
Yeah.
And idea or one sort of application of type theory is to use the language of type theory to synthetically talk about higher categories. And that seems to be very attractive to non-logicians, right? I mean, it's an application of type theory outside of logic, right?
Yeah, I like that idea. That's a good point. Thank you, Torsten, for bringing that up. There's a new kind of, maybe one of the people who's urged this point is Emily Reel, and you can look her up and find talks about her talking about infinity categories and infinite dimensional mathematics and so forth being difficult to capture in traditional foundations of mathematics. But type theory, and in particular homotopy type theory and related systems of type theory, provide a way of dealing precisely with these kinds of infinity mathematics. And that's quite I think should be useful and exciting for mathematicians who are not just, or not only logicians or type theorists, but who are interested in these higher dimensional mathematical structures as well. The type theory provides a way of reasoning rigorously and even formally using a computer about such infinite dimensional structures. That's a good point, yeah.
Which come up in physics, right? In quantum field theory, like if you listen to O. Schreiber.
I guess, yeah, I don't know anything about
that. And quantum gravity, whatever.
I don't know anything about that, but I think...
We will have him at the podcast as well.
Oh, good idea, yeah, have Ors. So, yeah. He'll tell you all about that, yeah.
Yeah. And Emily Reel, we should also get.
Should have Emily too, podcast. Yeah. She has a lot to say about that. Yep.
Suggestion. Yeah, there's so much more to ask about the sociology in the Advanced Institute in Princeton, how to write a book collaboratively, about the other models, what are cubical types. I mean, if you have lots the time, maybe we should have another episode.
Some other time, yeah.
There's but I guess we should come to an end.
For today.
Yeah.
Okay.
So thank you so much. It was super interesting.
Well, thank you for your interest. Thank you for your interest. And it was a pleasure talking to both of you.
I mean, just a very tiny remark. I mean, you might need to wait longer, but when I was a student, I found this hot so interesting that it was like the starting point of my first edited volume. And this is where I met Torsten.
Okay.
So Reflections on the Foundations. Of mathematics, where we compared set theory with other approaches. And I think you influenced many people, and it will take a while before tenure.
Okay.
I mean, the first one's already got, right? There was a huge amount of projects, so many postdocs in the area, and a lot of them found permanent positions now.
Yep.
So I don't think it's over yet.
I think we've got a foothold or toehold in the scientific community. I'll plug a book too. I don't have it here. I wish I could show the book.
Yeah, but
plug a book, and that's Egbert Rijke's new Introduction to Homotopy Type Theory, which has just been published by Cambridge University Press. I got one in the mail because I gave a blurb to put on the back cover, so they sent me one for free. So, and I just saw it. It's just beautiful. I'm very happy.
Yeah.
And any students who are interested in learning homotopy type theory, of course, the hot book is the Bible of homotopy type theory, but Egbert Rijke's book is a textbook for homotopy type theory which you can actually learn it. So go ahead and look at that. I think it's even free online. But anyway, go ahead and buy it. Egbert could use the money.
Yeah, it's better. Egbert deserves the money, certainly.
Yeah.
And I mean, it contains more things, right? The hot book is maybe even outdated for such a fast
brain. I wouldn't go that far, but...
Yeah, okay. Maybe it doesn't feature all of the newer developments. Maybe that's
true. Egbert's
book is
a better way to put it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Then again, thank you.
Thank you. And thanks very much.
And you all should subscribe now and comment and do whatever these algorithms want to see, even if Torsten studies algorithms. I guess it's fair to say that. No. The YouTube algorithm has its own rules, and I guess our audience know that better than we do. So thanks for tuning in.
Okay.